Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. It's Anne Wilson here, and it is my pleasure to host Emerge Australia's podcast series for 2026, brought to you during ME Awareness Week. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea, and community, and pay my respect to elders past and present, and those listening to this podcast, noting your continuing contributions, struggles, and achievements. When I consider the times in which we currently live, the lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine seem to resonate with what I am sure we all wish for, and that is a world where the brotherhood of man is celebrated globally, a peaceful world, a world without war, and a world without stigma or discrimination, where we have equity of access to healthcare, to treatments, to clinical services, and to cures. I'm sure you'll agree that John Lennon's lyrics of Imagine are visionary. They were written in 1971, and they are as relevant today as they were then. In this series, designed to focus on post-exertional malaise or PEM, our key theme for World ME Awareness Week, I'm absolutely delighted to interview people with ME/CFS to share their lived experience of PEM and to discuss the hidden harm of trying harder. This podcast series may include discussions on sensitive topics, including mental health and other health-related information. Some listeners may find this content confronting, triggering, or challenging. The information shared is intended for general informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice, so listener discretion is advised. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Louise DiPino as our guest. Louise is a trained social worker with extensive experience as a peer facilitator. Louise has lived with ME/CFS for 25 years, along with other comorbid conditions. Throughout the years, Louise has advocated for and provided support to a number of people with chronic illnesses. Louise has previously facilitated peer support groups for the Royal Children's Hospital and for Emerge Australia. Louise strives to create a safe and inclusive space where individuals can find solidarity, resources, and encouragement on their journey. Welcome to this podcast, Louise.
Oh, thanks so much, Anne. I appreciate being here.
Yeah, it's great talking with you again.
Yeah.
So you were part of the very original crew when I started as CEO of Emerge Australia. And it was great working with you. And I'm so delighted that we get a chance to catch up again on this podcast.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
So in reading that intro, you've been living with ME/CFS not just for an extensive period, but for 25 years. That's a long time. Are you able to share your personal journey with us and how you've navigated the challenges of this illness over the years?
Yeah, so probably before I start, I need to acknowledge my privilege in accessing medical care for ME/CFS. It's important to, like, I genuinely believe that because I'm white and cisgender, and unlike many ME/CFS patients, I had a supportive parent and GP initially that advocated for me when I first got sick. And I think it's important to recognize that because of that, I was able to have an advantage from the outset, which many patients often do not get with ME/C and long COVID. So I think that's just important to recognize.
Yeah. And can I ask you, did that stretch to early diagnosis?
No, actually. I think so. When I mention that, what I mean is that I think I was lucky in the fact that I was believed that what I was experiencing was real from the outset. My mum believed me, and my GP at the time, when I was 12 years old, believed me. That is not necessarily what occurs for people, but it unfortunately didn't mean that I actually got diagnosed any earlier. It still took about 6 years to get a diagnosis of ME/CFS. Yep. But yeah, so yeah, it's unfortunate that it didn't make it quicker. But I suppose in terms of my journey, I've been sick for, as you said, 25 years now. So I was about 12 years old when I came down with what my parents and I thought was a virus. And I basically just didn't get better from that virus. And then started a really long journey of lots of doctor's visits, you know, lots of specialist appointments, lots of tests. And unfortunately, I just got sicker and sicker. So I ended up missing about 4 years, because this was year seven when I first got sick. So I ended up missing about 4 years of high school. And funnily enough, my first diagnosis happened to be fibromyalgia. And that was just purely based on luck. And then I got the ME/CFS diagnosis. And then along the way, I've had POTS and psoriatic arthritis diagnosis as well. But yeah, but I would say in terms of navigating the challenges, look, it's tough. It is very, very tough. But I think one of the key things was I became very adaptable. I learned to adapt. And I think in a way, because I was young, I think I had more ability to adapt in a way. You know, it was just, this is how I need to keep moving forward. And so I basically ended up getting through high school due to extensions and special consideration. And then it took me about 8 years to complete my social work degree. But in terms of, I suppose, how my ME/CFS has affected me, the impact. My ME/CFS over these 25 years has been very fluctuating. So I've had periods of being severe where I've needed help being fed, washed, and toileted. I've also had periods where I've been able to work part-time and maintain a small social life. I'm now predominantly housebound and, you know, really try to pace as much as possible in order to maintain a little bit of part-time work. But I think in terms of that, that probably also relates to a little bit when we're talking about PEM, because I think a key part of my journey was that ME/CFS really was not known about. Back then it was called chronic fatigue syndrome. And in terms of the knowledge out there, it was very, very limited. So I didn't actually get taught anything about PEM. I was often told to listen to my body. I understand now that that was my doctors, in a way, telling me to pace. But from first getting sick to about my mid-20s, I was stuck in like a boom-bust cycle, because that was the only way I suppose I adapted and learned that in order for me to try and do anything, I have to push myself. I have to overexert myself. And then I would just crash. And then basically I would cross my fingers and hope that I would bounce back. But then
I'll interrupt you there. I was going to ask you, take you back, use of the word adaptable, because just listening to what you are saying and outlining, I would also add another word, and that is you're resilient, because it sounds to me like not only have you adapted to the changing circumstances that your body has put you through, but you're driven, you know. It sounds as though that you've had a desire to move forward and succeed and not necessarily allow this illness to rob you of everything that you want to do. Is that a fair?
Yeah, and look, I would probably say it's almost to my detriment because it meant that I, as I said, I easily got stuck overexerting myself more than I probably should. Learning to pace is still something I struggle with today in terms of pacing is an ongoing struggle that I do, that I have. But I think as well, you know, that reflects a lot of the ME/CFS and long COVID community. I think all of us are very driven people, and almost in a way, it's to have an illness like this, it pushes you to a point mentally where you would do almost anything to just accomplish anything. And that's something that I think a lot of us have to be so conscious of, and where we can end up having, you know, falling into the crashes quite easily because we do overexert, because we still want to experience life. We still want to reach goals and have those things happen. So it's been a learning curve for me in my, I suppose, late 20s. That was when I actually took time to learn about PEM and pacing. And that's when I began to actively like put in strategies around pacing. I think before I was saying I was pacing, but really all I was doing was I was pushing, and then I was giving myself rest days and then hoping that I just wasn't going to crash. And so, yeah, so now I think I'm a lot more active in my pacing strategies.
So at what stage did you actually get a diagnosis of either chronic fatigue syndrome or ME/CFS?
So I got that when I was, I think, 17 or 18. So
is that a relief?
At the time, it actually made me more confused. I think, and I'm not sure if maybe other people listening have experienced, where sometimes when you have multiple comorbidities, you'll have doctors say, oh, this is the primary diagnosis, but back then that's what I was told. I was told that ME/CFS is my primary diagnosis, and that, you know, fibromyalgia and POTS would be secondary. And so that, you know, kind of shifted things in terms of, you know, it was a completely different ball game of what I was now focusing on versus what I'd been focusing on before. And yeah, so I think that for me, it just meant that I had to sort of reframe what I had understood up until that point about my body. And I had to sort of learn again and be open to the fact of, okay, my body's also, even though I was still having these symptoms, it was now I have to give context to those symptoms by recognizing, oh, this symptom is probably the ME/CFS, which before I was just pushing, like I was putting all the symptoms under whatever diagnosis I had at the time. But now I was beginning to differentiate and be like, okay, so this, doing this could help this symptom because it's ME/CFS, if that makes any sense.
So it's like teasing out, you know, it's like, you know, teasing out all the elements and trying to figure out what bit relates to what other bit. And
because
get a whole picture.
Yeah, because it's also about, you know, if you're not really recognizing where your symptoms fit under the broader scope, you also then can't really apply, you know, strategies or, you know, ways to treat those symptoms, because oftentimes differing diagnoses will have differing strategies or management kind of things behind them. And so, you know, if you're not having that understanding from the get-go, you might not actually be treating it correctly. So for example, when I got the diagnosis of ME/CFS, we started on a whole regimen of, in particular, like, you know, things like melatonin. I was doing like a lot of additional things like magnesium and all that kind of, like all these extra things that just were not even in the sphere of being looked at in the fibromyalgia kind of space. So, yeah, so that sort of is like, it can be so beneficial when you get that diagnosis to actually begin to understand where your symptoms fit under it.
Yeah, of course. So as a social worker and as a peer facilitator, talk a little bit about how the unique insights you've had, a person with ME, and the journey you've been on from 12 years of age to now, how do those perspectives, how are you able to weave those perspectives into supporting individuals with ME/CFS today in the work that you do?
I think, well, one of the key things that I learned in my social work training is something called systems theory, which is a holistic approach. I know you're aware of it, Anne, but in case other people don't know, but it's a holistic approach that understands that people are connected to the world around them. It's an understanding of like a person in their environment, and that, you know, the environment impacts a person and the person impacts their environment. But in terms of that environment, there's multiple systems around them, where it's family, community, and society. And basically, I think that sort of became a very core understanding or lens I just use in life, where I endeavor to understand a person within their context. So I suppose that perspective has meant that when I've facilitated my groups, I'm very aware and open to the systems each group member brings into those sessions. Because look, ME/CFS and long COVID is impacting multiple levels within someone's world. So it's not just physically and mentally people are bringing whatever's occurring within them, but it's also things around their relationships with family and friends, their connection to community, study, work, healthcare, even their connection to culture, to social and political norms. So what that has meant is that the results of these impacts to people's systems means that as a peer facilitator, I'm not just like hearing discussions specific to ME/CFS and long COVID. I'm also hearing things involving like lack of access to education and community. I'm hearing things about financial instability. People are discussing things around like medical trauma or housing instability. But then also two things very prevalent within our community is social isolation and loss of identity. And a lot of these areas of discussion were not exactly a surprise, because I think my social work background, in particular within the homelessness sector, almost made me ready for it, because the homelessness population is similar to the ME/CFS and long COVID community, because they too go through a profound loss of their support systems and they experience high levels of social isolation. You know, and the thing is, it's really understood that when people lose connection to community, connection to social supports, experience a high level of social isolation, there's usually worse outcomes for those people, which is why peer support is so intrinsic and crucial in our community, like within our ME/CFS and long COVID community. It's not a solution to our problems, but I think what it does is it builds a protective layer around us, because it helps us to maintain a sense of dignity and a sense of self while going through these things, often not supported in that process.
It's really interesting that we're talking about this, because one of the previous meetings I had, we were talking about, you know, people with ME/CFS not really living in a bubble, because people with ME/CFS have all the impact of all the other conditions that everybody else does. So you're talking about homelessness and social isolation, but what about domestic violence?
Yeah.
What about women's health issues?
Mm-hmm.
So everything else that everybody else in the community experiences actually sandwich on top of the ME/CFS.
And it can be amplified.
One thing that people with ME/CFS are dealing with, it's all of those other things that really, in terms of the science, are not being recognized or linked back
to
a person with an energy limiting condition. So I think that the way you are explaining it to people in your groups is really terrific because, you know, it creates that validation.
Yeah.
Their experience, which is often lacking, as you know, too well.
Yeah, definitely. Sometimes the biggest thing, it's often so small, but so many people within peer support groups are just seeking some sort of validation, just to be heard, basically, just to hear that, yes, this is really tough. And yeah, the amount of times that I just see relief in participants, like in the group members' faces, because they are recognizing that their experiences are similar to others. And they're like, oh, okay, I'm not alone in this. It's incredibly powerful.
So is that, you know, one of the impacts you believe of being part of a support group, that people with ME/CFS develop that realization that they're actually not alone, and that by hearing the trials and tribulations and the experiences of others in the group, it helps to sort of center people's own experience? And
It's often that they also, a lot of people have not really spoken about, have not been given an opportunity or a space to really actually talk about a lot of these things in the context of ME/CFS and long COVID. You know, it's either that, you know, it's trying to talk to family and friends, but you just feel that emptiness because they don't really understand, they don't get it, kind of thing. And so being able to have a space with people where when you're talking, you really get what they're saying, it creates such a reciprocal and beneficial, feeling of trust.
Someone
and
understands me.
Yeah, and belonging. I think also along with that, something that I think that occurs a lot within peer support groups, which is incredible, is that I think it also can build confidence in people and improves, and I know I mentioned the word earlier, but it improves adaptability, because often what a lot of people take from the groups is that it's being modeled to you through other people's experiences, how other people are living with ME/CFS and long COVID. And so people begin to feel a bit more encouraged. You know, I've found in a lot of my groups that if somebody is already using a mobility aid, suddenly others will be like, oh, I've been thinking about it, but I've been too embarrassed. But then they have a bit more confidence to be like, you know what, I'm going to give it a try. So I think that's also such an incredible thing. And then as well as that is, there's just so much wisdom, in particular within the ME/CFS and long COVID communities. I think there's so much community wisdom, so much resourcefulness, that within these groups, there's so much that people learn and are able to take away from the groups as well.
I mean, that's terrific to hear. And I think, you know, if I put myself in that situation, you know, let's say something like PEM. I think hearing from others about, well, how do you cope with PEM? How do you plan for PEM? Do you have PEM? How does your family respond to when you've got PEM? And what happens in your household when you can no longer do the things that you used to be able because you have PEM? Or are bedbound? Are these kinds of issues that would arise, and how would a group deal with those issues?
Yeah, main topics. they're usual topics. And look, the groups are fantastic. Again, as I said, there's a lot of acknowledgement, understanding, support, empathy, but then there's also depending on where a person's at, sometimes some people just need to be heard of just how hard it is, and that's what just needs to happen. But sometimes, you know, it's the offering of that practical, just how do you survive when you're experiencing PEM? And so then people offer things that they've been able to do, or they actively ask, what are people doing? So then they can learn to find out what people are doing, you know. So I'm often having sessions where people are just spending time just talking about tips and hacks of like chronic illness hacks and things like that to either to try and help you not get into PEM, or if you are in PEM, what to do, like how you can better manage it, or how can carers of you better manage your PEM.
Do you find that there are any resources or strategies that you share with the groups that are better than others, or that land, you know, really well with your audience, that they go, yeah, that's terrific, I'm going to try that?
Yeah, so I think probably the two main ones that are usually either brought up consistently within the groups by individuals in the groups, or two that I often go back to is pacing and mobility aids. They are often the most practical things that we can utilize, that we can try and to put in place, and are relatively, like I'm putting this in quotation marks in terms of like mobility aids, relatively low cost, and are things that, you know, you can try and do. And so, you know, and then other things that are just a little things like baby wipe showers. That's a way of still having some personal care,
hygiene, yeah,
and that kind of thing. You know, things around like making use of, I suppose, our smart world by, like, you know, our interconnected world and delivery systems that we all have in place now, where, you know, if you can use grocery delivery, if that's something that's applicable within your situation, using that. So like little practical things that I think most of the time to trying to cover your bases can try and help overall.
Yeah. Now that sounds terrific. Certainly, if you're one of the challenges that has recently been highlighted in some work that we did was the specific challenges that people with severe ME have, and particularly those that are living alone.
Yeah. Yep.
And so to be able to make use of online services like, you know, delivery from supermarkets, so food delivery or whatever, you know, the services they need, to be able to get that brought in and manage all of that yourself, I would think would be a really great reason.
Yeah. Well, there's things often, something that in terms of like government support or council support or things like that, we also often are, you know, talking around things around in terms of like council support. So home and community care for young people, yeah, in particular, accessing that, like helping people to, often most people don't know that that's something that can be accessed. And then, of course, it's talking about Centrelink, and it's talking about NDIS. It's talking about, you know, what kind of, how can you engage in these, I suppose, incredibly difficult systems to navigate when you're so unwell. So, yeah, I think our severely ill community, they are in incredible need. And I think our support groups, when they're able to attend, because we have had very severe participants, and when they are able to attend, you know, they attend in the dark, they attend in their bed, often, sometimes they're masked, sometimes they're engaging in such a limited way possible, but the support that they often say that they're getting from the group is just, it's that connection that they're having to the outside world, and this is the one place that they're feeling heard and they're feeling understood just by hearing other people's stories. So yeah,
that's amazing. The fact, yeah, that people are feeling heard, which means they're not an outcast, feeling understood, is just so critical. And I can absolutely see that the support groups that you facilitate would provide that freedom and that safety for people to be able to express themselves to each other and also to you. So that's a gift that those support groups have got in having you as their facilitator.
Oh, thank you.
Can we go back a little bit to PEM for a moment?
Yeah.
So PEM's a significant aspect of ME CFS. Do you ever have to explain PEM to people not familiar with the condition? Because, you know, we have so many people who, A, don't even believe in people having ME-CFS, let alone post-exertional malaise. How do you go with explaining it to clinicians, allied health professionals? And what's your advice to people around reducing the impact of PEM on their daily lives?
Yeah, so one of the things that I think is incredibly important that often takes time to learn is language that explains and distinguishes the experience of PEM. Because oftentimes, you know, when you don't have that language, when you don't have that ability to explain it, you know, you rely on, and I did this a lot when I was growing up, like the only way I could explain it was things like, I'm so tired after I do everything, you know, or I feel so sick after I do anything, or I, you know, I tried to have a shower and then I couldn't get out of bed for the rest of the week, which, you know, at the time, the people around me didn't understand that this was PEM. But I think as well as that, I didn't, you know, I don't have the knowledge of language that I do now in order to explain it. And so I think most people on their journeys with ME-CFS and long COVID, it's unfortunately takes a bit of time to begin to learn the language that can help you to explain it. So now in terms of, I suppose, I really focus on helping a person understand how PEM is different from fatigue. I think one of the big things that often happens, it's not just people really struggle, you know, I think often if you just explain PEM on its own, people will just think it's a version of fatigue, or, you know, maybe just a severe version of fatigue or something like that. Like that's if people are trying to understand. But what I often do is explain that living with ME-CFS means that I am often always dealing with symptoms, you know, in terms of like cognitive dysfunction and fatigue and you know, lots of different things kind of just existing. But then what that means, but the experience of living with ME-CFS is also the experience of your body not functioning properly, where it's not producing energy or replacing energy in a way that an able-bodied person is. And then I will often then like remind the person that every person is using energy constantly to do anything, you know. So I'll talk about like things around like, you know, like things around like brushing your teeth or writing a text message or, you know, even just like managing sensory input. Your body's constantly always using energy to function. And then because my body is not functioning in terms of how I am producing energy and how I'm replacing energy and how I'm using energy, it means that when I do an activity that shouldn't mean that I use so much energy, my body uses it. It will use it all up to do that one thing, like write a text message. And the result of that is something called PEM. And what PEM then does is it will amplify all my symptoms. So I will start to almost go into, almost as if like I'm going into the flu, where I am going into severe fatigue, you know, huge amounts of brain fog, not being able to, you know, stand due to orthostatic intolerance, runny nose, you know, sore throat. And then it's not going to get better just by resting or sleeping, because it's really about my body needs to try and then make this energy up again. But because it's so dysfunctional, it's going to take either a very extended period of time, or sometimes it won't replace it at all.
Yeah. So I keep thinking as you're talking, that's why we came up with the brand identity of a battery.
Yes. Yeah.
And we use that really often, that, you know, someone with ME-CFS just isn't able to recharge their battery like someone who hasn't got ME-CFS. So, you know, if you plug your cell phone in at night, you'll wake up in the morning and with a bit of luck, it'll be fully charged. But if you're looking at sleep as being a way of refreshing the energy supply in your body, and you go to bed at night and you sleep and you wake up in the morning feeling more tired than what you started out with before you went to bed, that's an issue. And so, yeah, that's just such a challenge. And look, you're so right. As you were talking, what came to my mind was my own experience with one of my children who at the age of about 17 contracted Epstein-Barr virus. And then she started, you know, a long time after that. Her doctor said, I think you've got some chronic fatigue syndrome. And I went, yeah, whatever. As a sympathetic mother, I knew nothing about it, nothing. I was working in a different area of health. I knew nothing about it. And I said, just go to bed and rest and don't talk on the phone so much. You'll be fine. I mean, you know, I feel so guilty about that behavior to my then 19-year-old daughter who, you know, had trouble standing up. She's a lot better these days, but, you know, I just recall that for people around you who don't understand what you're going through, it's just such a lonely experience. And I still feel guilty for not validating what my child was experiencing when she actually had ME/CFS. And
it's so it's tough, though, because, granted, it's hard because we live in a world where we don't understand these things. You know, we live in a world that is quite ableist in how we understand disability.
Absolutely.
And so, and your responses, you know, though it may not have been the best at the time, you were just doing what you've learnt, those internalized beliefs, and that can be so tricky.
But at the same time,
that experience of learning and recognizing now is, I'm sure you have had plenty of conversations now that have truly reflected what you feel and how much you regret, probably.
Oh, absolutely. And if someone had told me then that the majority of people who get Epstein-Barr virus will end up with a fatigue-related illness like ME/CFS, I would have gone, oh, my goodness, this is, you know, this is something really serious. But I didn't.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really negated the experiences of my daughter. And I believe that there will probably be a lot of people out there who've got loved ones that have got ME/CFS, that go through PEM, that have no energy to get out of bed in the morning because their batteries are faulty.
Yeah.
One of the groups, I think it's the Irish group, they call themselves the broken battery.
Yeah.
Battery's broken. And, you know, we've got to find ways of fixing it so that people can live the best possible life that they can.
But you also raise a huge point of education around PEM is lacking. It's lacking within actual like ME/CFS and long COVID communities. A lot of the times, you know, people who are newly diagnosed or newly starting to like have symptoms, you know, often it can still take a very long period of time. You know, some of the groups that are, you know, having the illness for 2 years or more. And sometimes a lot of the in these groups, I'm explaining PEM to them. Oh. They haven't had anyone explain it to them. They've maybe received the diagnosis, but no one's explained what PEM is. Yeah. And so if the people who are actually experiencing this are not getting explained what PEM is, then that also means that their carers and their family and friends are not having any explanations either. So
yes,
it's a ripple effect that really, really creates such a lack of support and care around the person experiencing this.
Well, that's why we decided that this year we would focus on PEM because, you know, trying harder and trying to rail against it actually doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so we've focused before on stop, rest and pace, but we're now saying identify post-exertional malaise and don't try to push harder because it actually is damaging. The harder you rail against it, the worse you end up feeling. But that's why this campaign for World ME/CFS Day, Awareness Day, is so critical. So we've almost come to the end of our time. I've really enjoyed speaking with you.
So have I.
I'd like to ask you, finally, given your very in-depth understanding of what the community are going through, is there a message of hope or encouragement you'd like to share with our listeners who might be struggling right now with PEM, might be in the pits of post-exertional malaise and ME/CFS and or long COVID or any of the other associated energy-limiting diseases that have this range of symptoms? Is there a word of hope from your perspective or encouragement that you've got?
Yeah, so I think one thing that I know when I was younger, I was very against anyone being too hopeful or positive because I needed reflected back to me the reality of that this is just really tough. But what I think that helped me get through, and in particular the hardest times, was, and this, funnily enough, this is a lyric from a song, but this lyric has stayed with me and resonated with me, and it's, there's beauty in the breakdown. And what that has meant, and over time, I suppose, what this lyric has turned into for me is basically that it's focusing on what you can around you. And that even though things may appear broken, there is still things that can provide relief, can provide support, can provide joy, comfort. And often that means, and I think one of the biggest things that people go through in learning to live with ME/CFS and long COVID and energy limiting diseases, it's transitioning to beginning to focus on those small things, beginning to look for glimmers, beginning to look for the small things to keep you going and to keep you surviving. And those small things can be so, you know, like, for example, someone from my group, a group of mine, you know, their experience of caring for a partner with severe ME/CFS, they had their children draw some pictures because the children can't be around their mum. And so they had their, you know, their children put some pictures up on the wall so the mum can still be connected to their children. You know, she can look over and still feel that connection. And sometimes that's what I suppose learning to live with ME/CFS and long COVID is. It's finding ways to still feel connected to the world around you, to the people around you, in the ways that you can manage. And then as well as that, it's really important to build self-compassion. I think that's intrinsically, we are the toughest people on ourselves. We are the ones that are beating ourselves up probably even worse than the ME/CFS and long COVID. And so learning to be compassionate with ourselves throughout this journey is incredibly important. So
just such a beautiful note to finish on. I think as adults, we're often very hard on ourselves anyway.
Yeah.
But when you understand the frustration and the grief and the loss that people with ME/CFS go through, the tendency to be really hard on yourself and not look for the beauty in the small things is very high. So I think that you've left us with a beautiful vision of hope and compassion. And Louise DiPino, thank you for being my guest on today's podcast. I'm sure that our listeners will just be lapping up your words of wisdom that have come from your own life experience. So thank you so much for sharing with me.
Oh, thanks so much, Anna. I feel very privileged to have this opportunity. So thank you.
Wonderful. So today's podcast is part of our World ME Awareness Week series that Emerge Australia is recording with those with living with ME/CFS. This is a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID in Australia. If the content of this or other Emerge Australia podcasts has triggered an emotional response for which you feel you need assistance, feel free to contact Lifeline on 13 11 14, their Crisis Support and Suicide Prevention Service. You may also wish to go onto the Emerge Australia website where emergency services are listed. Tune in again for our next interview and don't forget that for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter, which tells you all about what we're doing at Emerge Australia, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au. Once again, Louise, thank you so much for being my guest. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And I hope someday you'll join.